You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show that airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Welcome to The Weekend. I'm Angela Cocherga, and I'm filling in for Louis Sines this week. And my guest today is Ruben Garcia, director of Annunciation House. Welcome, Ruben.
Thank you so much. What a delight to be here with you this morning.
I know you're very busy, and we have a lot of ground to cover. It's been a very busy year here on the border, everything from the zero tolerance crackdown that separated hundreds of families to the asylum issues we saw at the ports of entry with people being turned away to the Tornillo Tent City for the young people. But let's start out, Ruben, by kind of giving people a sense. A lot of people know you from news stories, and they hear the Annunciation House name. But tell us about the organization. It's much more than a shelter than that one house.
Correct. Annunciation House actually has three buildings that it oversees that we've had for many, many years. Annunciation House itself is now approaching 41 years of its existence. And we've been doing hospitality in our buildings throughout that entire period of time. Whenever there are these, what we refer to as surges, there's absolutely no way that we could accommodate the numbers in our buildings. And so what we do is we partner primarily with church organizations in both El Paso and the Las Cruces area, churches that are willing to receive refugees on certain days of the week. In addition, we also open up, we activate other sites that Annunciation House supervises directly that operate 24/7 because of the numbers. I think it's important for people to keep in mind that the Central Americans have been arriving here at our border, you know, since right before 2014. We heard a great deal about it in 2014 because there was a wave at that time. Not that they weren't arriving before that wave, but they were arriving in numbers that really didn't go onto anybody's radar. When the wave came, then it created a tremendous amount of news attention. And with that wave of families coming up from Central America, there were also a good number of unaccompanied minors that also came up that really captured the news media. So this is something that's been going on nonstop. And periodically there are these waves, these moments of where there's a surge. And right now we're in one of those moments.
Well, Ruben, you've been doing this a long time. Explain to people how you started Annunciation House, you with others who care about the issues, the migrant refugee issues.
Well, actually, something, the history of Annunciation House, there were five of us that started Annunciation House. And, you know, when we started, we did not specifically set out to open up a house of hospitality for refugees. That became our mission after we had actually moved into the building. Five of us moved into the second floor of this old building in downtown El Paso. And really, our initial goal was simply to place ourselves among the poor and to see in El Paso where the poor would take us. What we were trying to wrestle with is the realization that the God of creation identifies first and foremost with the least among us. You know, in all faith traditions, you're going to hear that whether you use the word God, whether you use the word Allah, whether you use the word Jehovah, that being identifies first and foremost with the least among us. And so we asked ourselves the question in El Paso in 1978, who might that be? And so we started walking the streets, and in the process, we encountered people who were on the street for various reasons, and we would refer people to resources that we thought could help them. And then one day, something happened. Someone we referred to one of the shelters that existed at that time came back and said, "Where you sent me, they will not help me." And when we asked why not, the response came back, "Porque no tengo papeles," because we're undocumented. And honestly, we didn't realize that in 1978, none of the shelters for the homeless that existed at that time would accept undocumented people. And we didn't know that. And once we reflected on that, once we realized that that was the reality in El Paso 1978, we make the decision that Annunciation House would begin to receive the undocumented. And that's actually how Annunciation House started walking with the undocumented, the refugee, the immigrant, and we've been doing it ever since. That has come to define what Annunciation House is today.
Well, the mission, you've continued that throughout the years, throughout the decades, but there really has been an evolution of the kinds of people who are showing up, people fleeing real war in Central America, to people fleeing gang warfare in Central America, to people fleeing the drug violence in Mexico. Talk to me a little bit about what you've seen over the years. And today, of course, it's primarily families with children.
Correct. I consider myself extremely privileged to have been with Annunciation House throughout all this period because it's allowed me to see the evolution of migration. And you're correct. The numbers of people that have arrived at Annunciation House at any point over the 41 years has changed. There have been times when in the 80s we saw literally tens of thousands of Central Americans that were fleeing the civil war in El Salvador, that were fleeing the civil war in Guatemala. Honduras got pulled into it. So we saw a lot of Central Americans who were fleeing warfare. We then saw a lot of people from Mexico who came up for economic reasons in the 90s who would cross over in the hope of finding employment in the United States. And that's a fascinating part of migration because, you know, if we reflect on the decisions of U.S. policy, so many mistakes have been made. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Mexicans would cross over, come work in the U.S., and then go back and spend the month of November, December, January. They had no intention of moving to the U.S. As enforcement became stricter, little by little, it forced them to start thinking in terms of remaining in the U.S. That's an example of the consequences of policy. We saw the arrival of many people from Mexico when the violence started in Mexico. What was the years of 2006, 7, 8, 9, 10, when Juarez became the most dangerous city in the world? Very few people understand that in 2010, 2011, 100,000 people from Juarez literally walked across the border and started living in the El Paso Las Cruces corridor, and many of them continue to live here. And so now we're seeing the Central Americans who have been coming up since, you know, 2012, 2013, 2014, and connected with that is so much the results of drug consumption and the transfer of huge amounts of money into both Mexico and the Central American countries, the triangle, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras.
And dealing with that kind of organized crime and gangs that go hand in hand, forcing
very
some
much so.
People fleeing.
Very, very much so.
Well, I've known you, Ruben, for many years, since I started as a young radio reporter, public radio reporter, and then through my television news years, and now with the Albuquerque Journal. And, you know, I really got to see you a lot this summer. It was such a busy time. And there's one moment that stands out. I remember that I was invited in to witness, really, your interaction with this mother. She had just been released, Central American mother, was wearing the ankle monitor, and was very distraught. She did not know where her four-year-old little girl was, and that was the first time she had a chance to ask somebody, what's happening here? You sat down, and in the middle of all this really chaos, and almost she was almost verging on hysteria, as you can imagine, you calmed her down, and you told her you were going to find her daughter. And you did that over and over again. Tell me about those moments.
Yeah, to say that they are special doesn't capture it. You know, right now, as you mentioned this, I'm remembering taking a mom to the airport to pick up her little boy, and being there at the airport. It was 10 o'clock at night, and she gave the okay to invite members of the media to be at the airport, and the escort from the ORR facility, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, who traveled with a little boy. They come down the stairway there at the airport, and the little boy is disoriented at the beginning and looks around and then captures the sight of his mom. And you see this little boy just make a dash into the arms of his mom. How do you describe what it's like to have the privilege of being able to witness those kinds of moments? And you can't. You can't. We're continually reminded of the consequences of policies that I believe are incredibly unjust, policies that result because of the never-ending effort to create a sense of fear between us and the refugee and the immigrant. You know, we have been told that these people are to be feared, and it's done for political motive. It's done for political gain, and so I just think it's very important to always speak about, you know, the humanness of the refugee and the understanding of the connection between us and what pushes people to leave their country, the kinds of violence that pushes people to leave their country.
Well, I had a chance to report out of Honduras, San Pedro Sula, and I did see some of those root causes and people seeing this as their choice, their only choice, and in some cases with when they have young children, especially teenagers, even leaving on their own because of the threats. But what would you say to people that say, why would people take this long journey and risk their children? I hear that repeatedly in my reporting, that they're putting themselves and their young children in harm's way. And clearly the policies are in place to deter people, but that doesn't seem to be working.
Yeah, I'm going to share a story with you that helps to get this across. We received a mom with a 3-year-old, and she happened to come from Juarez, and she arrived at one of our hospitality sites, and they called me early in the evening. They said, we received this mom with her 3-year-old, and she's telling us she wants to go back to Juarez, which is very unusual. And I said, all right, let me come up and I'll talk with her. And so I got there about 8 o'clock. I sat down with her and a lot of tears just listening to her. She tells me that her and her husband lived in Juarez. Her husband sold used cars. They had the 3-year-old, an 18-month-old, and the husband was being extorted, which is very common, very, very common, and he was paying. There came a point where he said to her, I'm going to stop paying. He had bought a motorcycle that wasn't working, and he left it at a motorcycle shop to get it repaired. And 10 days later, 2 weeks later, he got a call that the motorcycle was ready. So he said to his wife, let's go pick it up. And so as they arrived at the shop, there was a hit squad. Hadn't turned off the car, nothing. The bullets started flying. One of the bullets, several bullets struck her husband, and she pulled him away from behind the steering wheel. She got behind the wheel and just drove away, went to where there was emergency care. At that point, her husband was dead. One of the bullets went through the husband and hit the 18-month-old baby. The baby went into surgery, and the baby died in surgery. So her family said, flee. She took her husband's body, her baby's body, buried them in a common grave, and then fled, came to the bridge and asked for asylum. Now that she was in the shelter, she had spent 4 or 5 days in a holding cell, and you can imagine what was going through her mind. And she got to the shelter, and she couldn't get past the fact that her baby was in an unmarked grave, that there was nothing to mark that her baby. And she says she felt like she'd abandoned her, and she couldn't. She had to go back. And I told her, I said, you know, you've got a target on you. You saw them. You're in danger yourself. You're 3-year-old. Anyone you stay with is going to be in danger. Okay.
At risk.
I share that for people to understand. This mom can go to the police. The police aren't going to be able to do anything. There's no way to know if the people that were extorting her husband are connected to the police. And so people just don't go to the police. That's an example of why people flee. They flee from Mexico. They flee from El Salvador. They flee from Honduras. If you sit down with people, that's what they're going to tell you. They're going to tell you about having to pay extortion. The worst for me is when a mom says to me, or a dad says to me, because they've come up and they've got their 14-year-old son or their 14-year-old daughter or their 13-year-old, and they say, the reason I brought him up or her up is because she's at that age where I've already been approached and I have point blank been told, it's going to cost you so much per week for us to leave your son or your daughter alone. And so they flee. They flee. We find that impossible because we're so accustomed to picking up our cell phones and dialing 911. And of course, we get a response. The scenario that I ask people to imagine is, imagine you getting up in the morning and you're getting ready to go to work. Your kids are going to school and your phone rings, your cell phone rings, and you have someone, a voice that says, listen, I really thought that when you dropped Angela or Kristen or Isabel off at school, at middle school, yesterday the outfit she was wearing was really, really cute, and you're asking, who is this? It says, that's really not important, and she's really good at volleyball, and I noticed that she and her friend went to practice. Who is this? Who's calling me? That's really not important. And then eventually the conversation, you know, these are dangerous times and it's really important to protect our children. And I can help protect your child if you deposit. To receive that kind of a phone call, that kind of a phone call happens all of the time in El Salvador, in Guatemala, in Honduras. People flee. And when you ask people, why do you take the risk of making that trip, they look at you with a sense of, you don't understand. You just don't understand. What's the choice? What's the choice?
It's an impossible choice for many. And you're right. The children or the young people are told, you join us or we don't protect you. You're dead. I also saw when I was there that the young people are profiled by police, especially the young men. So even if they're not in a gang, they're often suspected of being. So that creates a whole other layer of issues. But this phenomenon, I mean, it continues to be not just regionally but globally. But we're really caught in the middle here as border communities. We've heard a lot about the caravan, the invasion. What are your thoughts about this issue of these caravans coming up from Central America?
Well, for the last several weeks, Annunciation House has been receiving approximately 2,000 refugees per week. That's the numbers that we are receiving on a weekly basis. So that amounts to about 300 refugees per day. Yesterday, we approached 400 that were released to us. So if you consider those numbers, it means that we've been receiving, you could say, a caravan every 2 weeks, the equivalent of a caravan. These refugees, almost overwhelmingly from Central America, are part of that human exodus of people that have made their way to our border. They're not part of an organized caravan. They're arriving in small groups individually or with smugglers that they pay to help them get up here. And they've been arriving at our border. So the reason I mention this is for people to understand that the arrival of refugees is nothing out of what is normal for a border community. And I would dare say that the overwhelming number of people listening to us this morning are totally unaware that this has been going on, because We've had all of these hospitality centers. We've been able to receive them, give them a place to stay, and then help them make contact with family or friends, relatives in the U.S., who then buy them a bus ticket or in some instances a plane ticket. We then take families to the bus station, the airport, and they leave. So all of these people don't remain in El Paso. They move on within 24 to 96 hours. So they don't stay because we've gotten very good at doing the hospitality, and the all the churches that are helping us have been beyond amazing in opening their doors. The vast majority of people in the El Paso Las Cruces area are totally unaware that these kinds of numbers have been arriving. So I use that as an introduction to the question of the caravan. The caravan is nothing other than a larger than normal group of people. It can be 500 people, it can be 1,000, it can be a couple of thousand people. If a part of a caravan, if a caravan were to arrive in Juarez, I have absolutely no doubt that once they are processed, once they are released, once they come to our hospitality centers, we'll be able to receive them, we'll help them make contacts, we'll take them to the airport, the bus stations, and they will be on their way. I think it's really important for your listeners to understand that all of this is being done without the use of one penny of tax dollars. These are the churches with their volunteers, with the people in their faith communities who are coming forward and saying, you know, here's the food, here's the Pampers, here, et cetera, to make it possible to be hospitable, you know. And so I think the caravans have been politicized for political motive and gain. I think that the policy of putting CBP officers at the top of the bridges to push people back is utterly political, utterly, utterly political. And it shouldn't be done. It has never been done up until the zero tolerance period when it was done. And even then, it was done for political reason. And it shouldn't be. We're using this for political gain, which is really tragic because we as a country are a hospitable country. We are the ones that have taken so much pride in that statue in New York Harbor that invites the world, that says to the world, this is who we are. And indeed, this is who we are.
Well, Customs and Border Protection will say, well, we're overwhelmed. We're not set up to handle families. The little holding space we have is for the one or two people we catch smuggling drugs or walking across or in their vehicles. So they said, we have to do this to funnel people through in an orderly fashion. The migrants are being told you can only come through ports of entry or you won't be allowed. The Trump administration said if you cross illegally, we're not going to even consider you for asylum. It's creating really a humanitarian crisis. Observers who've seen the people amassing on the border. This is a pressure cooker. People stuck in Mexico can't get through, and clearly not. Some may go back, but many are opting to stay and do something. Where do you see this going?
Well, I think it's very important to keep in mind that because the president signs an executive order saying you cannot apply, you no longer will be eligible. That's kind of like the president saying, I'm signing an executive order that beginning on Monday, 2 + 2 will equal 5. And under the belief that an executive order, in fact, makes it so. The truth is that immediately after he signed that order, the lawsuits came. And so that order has, in fact, already been put on a stay. And there's great question that you can take away people's right to ask asylum because they entered illegally. It's never been done before. It's these kinds of things are being done to respond to that group within the U.S. who believes that immigrants and refugees should not be allowed into the country at all. Period. And I think that's a really worthwhile discussion to have about do we want to allow immigrants and refugees to enter the U.S. I think that's a very, very good discussion to have. I don't think it's a discussion. I don't think that we should set policy on the fly without having that discussion. So, secondly, the idea that the ports, that CBP officers are overwhelmed, this right now, we're in the fourth surge since 2014. The policy of restricting people wasn't done for the first surge. It wasn't done for the second surge. It wasn't done when the Cuban surge came. And so you have to then ask yourself, why was it that during those surges, it wasn't done, and now it's being done? The other thing that is interesting is that prior to the emphasis in Tijuana and the caravan in Tijuana, where personnel from ports of entry in El Paso have been sent on temporary assignment to Tijuana, now the narrative is, well, the reason we have to restrict the numbers who come in is because we're short-staffed, okay, because we had to send some of our officers to Tijuana. So it's no longer that our holding cells are overcrowded. Now it's we don't have the personnel. Well, the question becomes, is it because the holding cells are overwhelmed? Is it because you don't have the personnel? Is it because it's not possible to really back up the numbers?
One last thing before we wrap up, Ruben. What do you see happening now? I mean, this isn't going to slow down. You do work with ICE and Customs and Border Protection to take the families and the people who are released. What are the needs? Because you are serving that function. There are no taxpayer dollars being spent to receive people.
Yeah. And again, it's very important, you know, because there's some people that say to me, we believe that the government should provide some tax money for this. This shouldn't be the responsibility of the churches and Annunciation House. What I say to them is we've never sought, we've never asked, nor would we accept any government funding because it gives us the autonomy and the freedom to do it the way that we are doing it. So we are able to do it, and it's the generosity of many, many people. You know, yesterday we activated a third hotel. We activated a very close to where we are now.
And you've had to rely on hotels because you've run out of room.
Correct. And so we activated a third hotel yesterday, and I had to go. I stopped in at Albertsons here to buy milk for breakfast this morning. It was yesterday. And so I had this cart full of gallons of milk, and I was at the checkout waiting my turn to pay. And all of a sudden, there's this guy that comes up and says, you're with Annunciation House. And I said, yeah, I am. Let me pay for this. I have to. You have to let me pay for this. And sure enough, they totaled up the milk and the other food items they were taking. And he came over and he paid for it. And he just said, I have to be part of what you are doing. I think that captures the spirit of hospitality in El Paso, in Las Cruces. This is who we are. And I'm so grateful that I live in this border community and that this is indeed who we are.
Thank you. My guest has been Ruben Garcia, Director of Annunciation House. So much to cover, Ruben, but thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here today.
What a delight. What a pleasure. Thank you so much, Angela.
The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Sam Casiano. Our producers are Dennis Wu and Vasil Zabanal. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Louis Science.